the view of spreading DNA. But life doesn't have to be about spreading DNA at all. All these buttons and tendencies can be recognized and overcome. Life can be about something bigger. But unless we understand how we're wired, we can't begin to program ourselves for whatever purpose we want for our lives. The complex and varied evolution of our sex drive gives us many of the most powerful buttons and tendencies that mind viruses use to program us. The number two drive, right behind sex, is survival. That's where we'll look for the next set of buttons that viruses of the mind exploit. Chapter 7, Survival and Fear. In prehistoric times, the most effective way to stay alive was to have a good, healthy relationship with two things, food and danger. The part of our brains that evolved to be attentive to danger was a huge help in the days when we had lots of threats to our survival in everyday life. I wonder how long it was, though, after the invention of language, that the first con artist separated the first sucker from his savings by making up a lie about some danger. Many myths and religions have some kind of threat of retribution from their god or gods, and their doctrines warn of the dangers of doing various forbidden things. Why? Because memes involving danger are the ones we pay attention to. As oral traditions developed, our brains were set up to amplify the dangers and give them greater significance than the rest. Once again, meme evolution took off the instant that communication of danger started taking place. Today, having eliminated most day-to-day threats to our survival, we find that our lives are still filled with danger memes. The more dangerous, the more we pay attention to them. Just look at all the attention we pay to, and the size of the industries built around, horror films and insurance against loss. There are safety films, of course, but who wants to go see them? The most effective safety film in my high school driver's ed course was called Mechanized Death. In contrast to all the boring films outlining normal safe driving habits, Mechanized Death showed several gory accident scenes, graphically depicting the danger inherent in driving unsafely. Although it was only one class period out of 25 or so, it's the one I remember, probably because danger was the only thing powerful enough to distract my attention from its normal high school priorities, lunch and girls. Danger, food, and sex. Because evolution favored safety, we have a lot more fear than we need. Why did evolution favor safety? Simple. Safety was a prime factor in reproduction. If we stayed safe, we lived to possibly reproduce. If not, we didn't. Genetic evolution wasn't interested in the quality of our lives, only the quantity of our offspring. Through the course of natural selection, staying safe became a more and more important drive in us and other animals. Fear is highly adaptive to whatever the current situation is. Specific fears are far from universal among human beings. In fact, since I used to be petrified of public speaking and now I look forward to it, I can say with confidence that fears change even within a single person's lifetime. Human fear is generated by hardware instincts viewing life through mimetic software programming. That programming consists of all the distinction memes, strategy memes, and association memes you got from everything you've ever experienced, heard, thought, or been taught. It's an incredible genetic leap that allowed us, and whatever other animals possess the ability, to protect ourselves against dangers we learn about only after we're born, and our genes are fixed. Over time, genes evolved and we found ourselves with several very identifiable feelings, all having to do with danger. That heightened awareness of some nonspecific danger is called anxiety. Good old fear is associated with a danger that we have the instinct to run away from. If instead our reaction is to stick around and fight, we feel anger. Then we've got mixtures and shades of these feelings, all with their own names. Nervousness, worry, suspicion, trepidation, and so on. Why has fear, this wonderful, complex, adaptive response to danger become such a burden on our modern lives? It's a complicated subject, perhaps rivaling sex in its ubiquitous intertwining in the fabric of our lives. The common thread, though, is this. We now live in an environment so far removed from the millennia during which our genes evolved that the fear, anger, danger mechanism is no longer appropriate to the task. Our lives today are about jobs, societies, and ideas, not lions and tigers and bears. But people treat cultural failure as if it were as harmful as physical failure, like being eaten. The instinctive reactions and emotions that evolution equipped us with are frankly bad for anyone who's interested in more than survival. Success in life depends on perseverance in the face of failure, yet our instincts about cultural dangers send us in just the opposite direction. We live in an age of great confusion and stress. Anyone who's ever had the desire to get away from it all has felt the pull of a simpler, less confusing environment, one that our senses were designed to make sense of. We don't just pay special attention to our own dangers. Since our genes are shared by our relatives, we also find our attention attracted to situations where we might help people sharing our genes at little cost to ourselves. We call this altruism. And interestingly, society seems to smile as surely on altruism as it frowns on personal indulgence. Both, however, evolved from the fittest gene survival. Here are some button-pushing memes relating to altruism. Helping children. The best thing you can do for your selfish genes next to surviving and reproducing is helping your children, or other children who share those genes, survive to reproduce themselves. Birds of a feather. Groups of people with like genes who hang out together and help each other have a better chance of survival, and also of keeping their gene pool from being diluted by outsiders. The fact that genes evolved to care more about themselves than individual people has a nasty side, too. How about these memes? Racism. Excluding or even fighting people with obviously different genes, the seamy side of birds of a feather, has the effect of preserving the status quo of the gene pool. Elitism. Any group of people who share and act on the belief that they deserve better resources, privileges, or treatment than others are more likely to survive and propagate their genes in times of scarcity. Helping children, birds of a feather, racism, and elitism are all memes that push our buttons. Along with crisis, danger, and some more complicated fear-based memes, these button-pushing memes are prime candidates for mind viruses to take advantage of in attracting our attention and penetrating our defenses. And the danger doesn't have to be real. We just have to think it might be. To get along in the modern world, we need to ignore our senses to a degree and live by the ideas, customs, and beliefs that exist solely in our minds. The fear reaction, though, seems to be one of the most difficult instincts to ignore. For that reason, memes that invoke a fear reaction and the attention we pay along with it have done very well indeed. By framing something as a cultural danger, advertisers can make people at least pay attention to their ads. Viruses of the mind often include fear-inducing memes. It's tempting to think that myths, proverbs, legends, and oral traditions are passed down because of either their factual truth or their particular usefulness in our lives. Being experts on memes, though, we now know that the stories, myths, and common wisdom that survive are the ones with, well, you guessed it, good memes. Are you superstitious? Even if you're not, you can probably name more things that supposedly bring good or bad luck than you can name presidents of the United States. Assuming for the moment that there's no real-world validity to these claims, why do we all know so many superstitions? A hint: this will have something to do with fear and memes. Most superstitions are based on the cheap insurance meme. For the apparently low cost of avoiding black cats, staying home on Friday the 13th, or tossing a bit of salt over your left shoulder, you get cheap insurance against something bad happening. Some superstitions throw in other memes, especially playing the streaks. Craps players want a successful shooter to continue rolling the dice until his winning streak ends. They get more and more excited with each random victory. Superstitions are bad only in the sense that if you're paying attention to salt and cats, you may miss out on something you would find more worthwhile. Or if you think your bad luck is being caused by that mirror you broke last year, you might not search hard enough for some real causes that you might be able to do something about. And since there are a few things we love to talk about more than danger, we pass these superstitions around freely. So superstitions become viruses of the mind, diverting our attention, affecting our behavior, and programming us to spread them to others. There's one big danger in living life with this outdated reverence we have for fear and its associated memes: making bad decisions based on fear. Because our instinctive reaction is to give this emotion much more weight than it deserves in modern life, we often miss out on great opportunities. Our tendency to overreact to cultural dangers applies not only to superstitions, but to many things we fear in everyday life: people's disapproval, failing to meet a goal, rejection, and so on. It all boils down to the fact that our fear reaction mechanisms are still calibrated for a time when the world was full of real threats to our survival and reproduction. Overcoming fear requires you to train yourself to think every time you feel fear, rather than just reacting instinctively. The thought process I use goes like this. I'm scared. Is it physical danger? No. What is my purpose in this situation? I'll make my decision consciously based on what helps achieve my purpose better, rather than unconsciously on my instinctive desire to run away from fear. That logical thought process was essential to my overcoming my stage fright and becoming a public speaker. After a while, it became second nature, and I didn't need to think all the words anymore. I just seemed to have created a new unconscious thought pattern, a strategy meme, that supported my agenda rather than some prehistoric DNAs. Logic is a wonderful thing. A boring truth seldom taught in success seminars is that clear, logical thinking and simply plodding ahead with a plan are great tools for success in life. Genetic evolution gave us the tendency to pay attention to certain memes. Note that I said tendency, not mandate. We have the ability to consciously override our genetic programming, and even over time, to reprogram ourselves to unconsciously pay attention to other things, if we decide other things are more important. Now that we know what the buttons are that memes push, let's take a look at how we get programmed. Chapter 8, How We Get Programmed. Here's the chapter you've been waiting for. It's all about how to manipulate people using memes and genetic buttons into doing exactly what you want them to do. You know what a meme is: a thought, belief, or attitude in your mind that can spread to and from other people's minds. You know that we human beings are the medium for the evolution of memes. You understand how evolution works by survival of the fittest, and how our own genetic evolution gives us buttons, tendencies to pay special attention to certain things, especially danger, food, and sex, which helped us survive and reproduce in prehistoric times. Now comes the scary, upsetting part. Memes enter our minds without our permission. They become part of our mental programming and influence our lives without our even being aware of it. We get infected by new memes in three ways. The first way is through conditioning or repetition. If we hear something repeated often enough, it becomes part of our programming. Advertisers and salespeople know this well. Any good book on sales will tell you that most customers don't buy until they've been asked 5 to 7 times. It takes that many repetitions to implant the "buy me" meme in the customer. The second way is through a mechanism known as cognitive dissonance. When things don't make sense, our minds struggle to make them make sense. Imagine, for example, that a friend is upset with you, but you don't know why. You have two memes that conflict, that are inconsistent: friend and upset with me. You resolve the conflict or dissonance by creating new memes, by rearranging your memetic programming so that things make sense again. Ah, Bill's upset because he's paid for lunch the last 3 times, you might conclude. Right or wrong, you now have a new meme about Bill and lunch that will influence your future behavior. I've heard it said that geniuses develop their most brilliant original thoughts through self-imposed cognitive dissonance. As you might guess, then, as a programming method, it's particularly effective with intelligent people, because you actually believe that the new meme is your own idea. The third way new memes enter our minds is by taking advantage of our genetic buttons in the manner of the Trojan horse. As we've seen, because of our nature, There are certain things we tend to pay special attention to, such as warnings of danger, cries of children, and sexual attractiveness. We are susceptible to bundles of memes that push our buttons to get our attention and then sneak in some other memes along with them. Simply getting programmed by new memes isn't the same as catching a full-blown mind virus, but viruses of the mind take advantage of one or all of these methods to make their initial inroads into our minds. Conditioning, programming by repetition, is the easiest way to acquire memes that don't push any of your buttons effectively. For instance, if you want to learn French, you listen to people speaking that language as you study the lexicon. At first, it just sounds like people clearing their throats and moaning, but after many repetitions, you begin to be programmed with distinction memes. Soon you can begin to distinguish French words and sentences where there was meaninglessness before. Remember elementary school? Learning to read and write. Memorizing the multiplication table. Conditioning by repetition works. Elementary school programming by conditioning was not limited to reading, writing, and arithmetic. We pledged allegiance to the flag of the United States of America every morning. Repetition, conditioning. That patriotism didn't spontaneously arise in each of us out of our spiritual nature, we were programmed. And it wasn't presented to us as a reasoned, logical argument. We just said it and heard it enough times, and poof, it became one of our beliefs, our values, our memes. Long-term prisoners can become institutionalized. They become so conditioned to the culture inside prison that they no longer want to live outside. They try to get back in once they're released. There's no reason to think that the long-term conditioning of a bad job or bad marriage doesn't have the same effect. Children typically get programmed with religious beliefs through conditioning by repetition. Whatever the religion, children go from zero beliefs to full-fledged faith by being told about the divinity of God or Jesus or David Koresh over and over again until those memes become programmed. Regardless of whether these religious memes are presented as truth or as allegorical mythology, you're conditioned just the same. You can be conditioned through repetition to acquire new distinction memes and provide reinforcing evidence that keeps those distinction memes in place. In psychology, the word conditioning often refers to implanting association memes. Pavlov's dog was conditioned to associate the ringing bell with food. When the Coca-Cola company pays millions of dollars to show you young people in bathing suits having a good time drinking their products, they are conditioning you to associate good feelings with their brands. The repetition of that commercial creates association memes in your mind so that when you push your shopping cart down the soft drink aisle, you get an irrational urge to buy Coke. It's possible to override that urge through conscious intention or the fact that other memes are stronger, but the urge makes a difference in their bottom line or they wouldn't be spending the money. There's also a term for the use of repetition to create strategy memes, operant conditioning. Viewing commercials or listening to bells ring is passive. It involves no activity or strategy. When you behave in some way and that behavior gets rewarded, that's operant conditioning. The reward creates and reinforces strategy memes. The classic example of operant conditioning is teaching a rat to run a maze. At first, the rat just wanders around. But soon he discovers there's a yummy piece of cheese tucked away in one corner, a reward. Quickly the rat learns to run directly to the cheese rather than just wandering. We use operant conditioning on our children constantly, grading their schoolwork, praising them when they do things we like. The repetition of these rewards conditions the children to behave in a certain way. It creates and reinforces strategy memes that, if we are good parents and teachers, will serve them as adults in their pursuit of happiness. However, operant conditioning can be used for many other purposes besides training you to pursue happiness. If you're in a situation where you're being rewarded for some behavior, think about what memes that operant conditioning is programming you with. Do they serve your purpose in life? Another programming technique is creating mental pressure and resolving it, cognitive dissonance. Why do high-pressure sales tactics exist even though people universally despise them? As with any why question in the world of memetics, the answer is because the meme for it is good at spreading. Salespeople get infected with the high-pressure sales meme and go about acting on it, regardless of whether it's the most effective means at their disposal. There's no question, however, that it does work on some people some of the time. High-pressure sales work by making you mentally uncomfortable, by creating cognitive dissonance. You enter the situation with some strategy memes that make you resist buying. Perhaps there's something like, look before you leap, or shop around before you buy. The salesperson programs you with a meme, making it attractive to buy immediately. If I don't buy now, I'll miss a window of opportunity, or even simply, if I buy now, the salesperson will like me. These new memes conflict with your old ones, and a mental tension is created. Your mind wants to resolve the conflict. It does so by creating a new meme. There are two ways to release the pressure caused by cognitive dissonance: buy in or bail out. If you bail out, it's likely to be because you've resolved the dissonance by creating a meme such as, the salesperson is a jerk. But some people buy, creating instead a meme like, I really want to buy this. Once you create that meme, it's yours, and a smart salesperson will reinforce it by telling you what a smart decision you've made and even calling a few days later and congratulating you on your purchase. Cognitive dissonance can be used to create a meme of submission and loyalty to whatever authority is causing the dissonance. Fraternity hazings, boot camp, and some religious or spiritual disciplines put people through difficult tests, and many demand demonstrations of loyalty before releasing the pressure. That creates an association meme between the demonstration of loyalty and the good feeling caused by the release of pressure. With cognitive dissonance, people end up believing they have received something valuable, something deserving of their loyalty, when in reality all that's happened is that the people who were torturing them have stopped. Prisoners of war have been programmed to submit and be loyal to their captors through this method. One interesting result of research in operant conditioning on people is that it works better to give the reward only occasionally than it does to give it all the time. That could be because withholding the reward adds cognitive dissonance to the operant conditioning. So a truly manipulative meme programmer will withhold the reward most of the time, even if the subject performs flawlessly, knowing this will create stronger programming. The ramifications of this research are interesting. People often say that the teachers who made the most difference in their education were the tough graders, the ones who withheld the A's much of the time. The occasional A reinforces the work hard meme more than the constant A because it adds cognitive dissonance. The Trojan horse method of programming works by getting you to pay attention to one meme, then sneaking in a whole bundle of others along with it. There are any number of mechanisms for doing the meme bundling. For one, a Trojan horse can take advantage of your instinctive buttons, pushing them to get your attention, and then sneaking in another agenda. A Trojan horse can also take advantage of the strategy memes you're currently programmed with, having to do with learning or believing. For example, people who have the strategy meme, if I trust someone, believe what they say, are susceptible to new mimetic programming coming from people they trust. People who have the strategy meme, believe things consistent with what I know, be skeptical of all else, are susceptible to new mimetic programming that seems consistent with what they already know. If you're programmed to believe what X says because it is the voice of God, where X is a person, a book, or even a practice such as meditation, you're easily programmed with any additional memes that come from X. The simplest bundling technique, one used frequently by politicians and trial lawyers, is simply saying the memes one after the other, in decreasing order of believability. The credibility of the first statements seem to carry over to the unsupported ones. For example, we all want freedom. We all want democracy to work for everyone. We all want every American to have the opportunity to pursue the American dream. And we all want a national healthcare system that makes that possible. Now, it's a bit of a stretch to conclude that federal management of healthcare has anything to do with freedom, democracy, or the American dream, but juxtaposing the statements like that seems to turn off people's natural skepticism. The questionable memes at the end of the bundle ride into your mind inside the Trojan horse of the acceptable memes at the beginning. Bundling the statements together like that is one form of a neurolinguistic programming, or NLP, technique known as embedding, or packaging memes to make people more susceptible to them. A related NLP technique is anchoring, taking some image, sound, or sensation and linking it to an unrelated idea. For example, a political candidate who gestures at himself when talking about a rosy future and at his opponent when preaching doom and gloom is actually anchoring good feelings to himself and bad feelings to his opponent. The repeated bundling creates association memes in your mind, which will later influence the way you vote. You can use anchoring on yourself to quickly put yourself in a good or enthusiastic mood. Close your eyes and imagine a time when you were excited and motivated. Create a vivid mental picture. Now, when you're immersed in that motivated feeling, lightly scratch the pad of your index finger with your thumbnail. You're anchoring that state of mind to that sensation. Open your eyes and come back to the present. Repeat this a few times over a period of days or weeks, and you'll find that next time you want to motivate yourself quickly, a gentle scratch of the pad of your index finger with your thumbnail will get you in the right mood. As with many of the techniques in this chapter, embedding and anchoring are used a lot by sophisticated salespeople. The whole point of sales is to influence people's beliefs, infect them with certain memes, for direct economic gain. It's natural that we'd see many effective meme-spreading techniques used by salespeople. An effective form of embedding often used in sales is the question-asking technique. One of the first things you'll learn if you take a good sales training class is that you must be the one asking the questions. You need to control the interaction by asking the right questions and leading the customer down the path leading to the sale. Why is that? You do it for exactly the same reason a trial lawyer asks a witness very specific questions. The attorney has a point she wants to prove and does everything possible to create a framework supporting that point. The lawyer creates mental images and attitudes in the minds of the jury. Real estate salespeople are trained to use you and your as much as possible. Would you like to go up and see your master bedroom? They ask. Simply by posing the question, they create and reinforce an image in your mind of you owning the house. They program you with an association meme. Pretty sneaky, huh? Of course, you don't need to ask questions to reinforce these mental images. Oh, look, here's your fireplace. You could knock this wall out and have a huge playroom for your kids. This is all still embedding. All these help create memes, but wise salespeople know asking questions, especially ones to which your answer is yes, helps get the sale. So another technique is to tag a little question on the end of these statements to program you with the strategy meme of saying yes. This bedroom is gorgeous, isn't it? This is just what you were looking for, isn't it? The very act of asking people a question can cause them to create or reinforce a meme in their minds. Asking enough of the right questions can actually change someone's belief system and therefore influence the person's behavior. The key to effective sales is finding what the customer considers valuable about your product and reinforcing that meme in his mind. Now, what the customer finds valuable may have nothing whatsoever to do with what the salesperson finds valuable. If you're a good salesperson selling a Picasso to someone who likes it because it matches the china, you won't tell them that that's not the right reason to like it. You'll sell him another Picasso from his blue period because it matches the tablecloth. The salesperson's job is to create a meme in the customer's mind that says, I believe I'm going to buy this. The best salespeople don't look upon the sale as an adversarial relationship, but as a genuine win-win situation. The customer gets something she wants, and the salesperson gets the commission. So the salesperson will be trying to get you to figure out why you want the product and trying to have you create memes reinforcing your belief in the product's value. Selling people on a concept, a whole bundle of memes, can have a far greater influence on their lives than selling them even a really great vacuum cleaner. When you sell people a bundle of memes, it can program them to spend the rest of their lives behaving the way you want them to. Marriage is one such memetic bundle. There's no physical reality to a marriage. It's just programming yourself with some new memes. It's adopting distinction memes for married, couple, and family. It's adopting strategy memes such as stay together, provide for each other, and so on, in order to preserve the marriage. It's adopting a whole set of association memes, connecting various feelings and ideas with marriage, commitment, and family. These days, it's common for two individuals getting married to have incompatible programming around marriage, conflicting strategy memes or incongruous distinction memes. A mimetic marriage counselor would identify those and allow the couple to reprogram themselves with compatible memes. You're more likely to buy a dubious-looking meme, like a dubious-looking used car, from a buddy than from a total stranger, right? Well, a good salesperson knows that and will do everything possible to create a buddy meme in your mind. How to create trust and rapport with a customer is one of the hottest topics in popular books and seminars on sales. The latest thing is to bypass your conscious mind and use NLP techniques to create rapport. One basic technique is known as mirroring. Mirroring is simply matching someone's body language. If she crosses her legs, you cross your legs. If she folds her arms, you fold your arms. If she tilts her head to one side and wrinkles her nose, you tilt your head to one side and wrinkle your nose. Beyond simply matching posture, a good mirrorer will get a feel for the rhythm of people's movements, the pace of their speech, the texture of their conversational style. If you can match all that, you'll be like a perfect dance partner and develop that instant rapport usually known as chemistry. Yes, this works well for charming potential mates as well. The masters of establishing instant trust and rapport are the people who run confidence games, con artists. Con stands for confidence, and the game works by gaining your confidence in them and then tricking you. They work by creating a meme in your mind that says, "I trust them." There are any number of ways to create that meme: appearing naive or innocent, performing a seemingly altruistic act, appearing to be part of a reputable organization. The most straightforward way, though, is by giving you their confidence first. By appearing to trust you, they hope you'll reciprocate. Then they get you. Gaining someone's trust is an effective way to bypass their skepticism and make it possible to program them with new memes. If you've been paying attention, you now know how mind viruses work. You know that a mind virus, or any virus, has three requirements: a method of penetration, a way of reproducing itself faithfully, and a means of spreading itself to other minds. If you currently believe in any concepts or subcultures or dogmas that meet these requirements, and you didn't consciously choose to program yourself with these memes, you're infected with a mind virus. If you're not aware that you currently believe anything like that, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not infected. It may just mean you're not aware of the infection. Here's what it looks like when you're infected by a mind virus. When a virus of the mind infects you, it may resemble one of these three scenarios. 1. Repetition. Repeating a meme until it becomes familiar and part of your programming is one method of mind virus penetration. Hearing a similar message repeatedly on television news, commercials, talk radio, and so on. Being in a group or organization where, for instance, a charter is read or an oath is taken at each meeting. Hearing a point of view or opinion repeatedly, for example, about gun control or abortion. 2. Cognitive dissonance. Being placed in a paradoxical or mentally uncomfortable situation can lead to being reprogrammed with new memes that relieve the mental stress. Going through an initiation or hazing or a series of tests. Taking a confrontational or uncomfortable seminar or course that gives a great sense of relief at the end. Reaching some goal or reward after a struggle or after having been told you're not good enough. And 3, Trojan horse. Bundling less attractive memes with more appealing ones. Listening to a concept that mostly seems right, but has a few components that kind of rub you the wrong way. Hearing appeals to help children, resolve a crisis, feed starving people, and the like. Being asked to believe something that seems odd just out of trust. Being presented with an opportunity to get more or better sex or relationships by adopting some new beliefs. This is by no means an exhaustive list of methods of penetration by viruses of the mind. However, if you're looking to see what mind viruses you're already infected with, looking back to see which of these scenarios you've been through may give you some clues. A mind virus needs a way to reproduce itself faithfully, without distortion or omission. That can be accomplished in a number of different ways. By instilling a belief that tradition is important. The way things have been said and done in the past is the way they will continue to be said and done. By saying a certain set of memes is the truth with a capital T, as many religions say about their sacred texts, why would you want to distort or omit the truth? By setting up a structure to reward verbatim copying and/or punish modification. The military has such structures set up to condition people to reproduce the policies and procedures faithfully. The eccentric spelling of the English language is preserved because of a pervasive meme that there are right and wrong ways to spell words. This meme has all kinds of support, including dictionaries, computer spell checkers, and children's spelling bees. But before the use-a-dictionary strategy meme became prevalent during the 18th and 19th centuries, people spelled words any way they wanted. It's not true with a capital T that there's one and only one correct way to spell a word. It's just a meme. We think it's true because all our lives people have been criticizing us for misspelling words. We've been programmed. Not that there's anything wrong with consistent spelling. It enhances communication, after all. But it's important to start seeing that all of what we think of as the truth is composed of memes. And most of these memes just came into our heads through programming, without any of our own conscious choice involved. Any beliefs you have about there being a right way and a wrong way to do things can and will be co-opted by mind viruses as part of their faithful reproduction machinery. Remember a foolish consistency? Consistency for its own sake is meaningless. Ask yourself if being consistent serves your underlying purpose, such as effective communication, or if you've just been programmed with a "be consistent" meme, leaving you open to mind virus infections. Spreading mind viruses is the flip side of penetration. If you're an influential or vocal person, if you produce television shows, if you speak in front of large groups, if you raise children, I want you to be conscious of what memes you're spreading. Naturally, a mind virus that infects people with memes that explicitly encourage spreading it will spread faster and more pervasively than one that just depends upon chance to spread itself. Some of the ways mind viruses encourage spreading are programming you with a meme like, "Get the word out before it's too late," pushing your crisis and window of opportunity buttons. Programming you with a meme to the effect that teaching this to our children will help them. Programming you to evangelize the virus. Some synonyms for evangelism are proselytization, passing the favor on, and enrollment. Evangelism has kind of a bad name in some circles. The paradox about evangelism is that in addition to being the mechanism used to spread mind viruses, it's also the main way people can have a positive impact on the world. You can have the world's greatest idea, but unless you shout about it, crusade, evangelize, it has no impact. Virus of the Mind is my attempt to consciously spread the bundle of memes known as memetics, which I see as essential to having our children live in a world of freedom, creativity, and personal power. I invite you to evangelize with me. Make sure the memes you're spreading are the ones you want the world to have more of. A virus of the mind is a cultural institution that contains all these ingredients. It is therefore self-perpetuating and self-replicating. It continues through time and reaches out and involves more people. Institutions that were designed by people for the specific purpose of perpetuating and spreading, I call designer viruses. But long before anyone came up with that Machiavellian notion, viruses of the mind evolved on their own into powerful cultural fixtures. I call the institutions that evolved on their own to become self-perpetuating cultural viruses. Chapter 9. Cultural Viruses. From the children's game of telephone, we know that it's difficult to copy memes with 100% fidelity, even if we want to. When replication occurs with slight changes in the replicator, and those modified replicators are selected somehow for their fitness, then we have evolution. When a concept appears that has all the properties of a virus of the mind, then as it starts spreading through the population, the memes constituting that concept evolve. Toward what end do they evolve? We now come to the key to the paradigm shift. These memes and the concepts and cultural institutions they compose care nothing for you, me, or our children, except as vehicles for their own replication. They don't exist to raise our quality of life or to assist us in our pursuit of happiness. Their goal is to reproduce and spread, spread and reproduce, whatever the cost. All cultural institutions, regardless of their initial design or intention, if any, evolve to have but one goal, to perpetuate themselves. Given the new organizations being introduced all the time, the surviving organizations must become better and better at surviving. Any use of their money or energy for anything other than surviving provides an opening for a competing group to beat them out for resources. If you're designing a cultural institution these days, you've got to know memetics. If you don't design the thing with good memes that will make it self-perpetuating from day one, it will either die out quickly or evolve to become self-perpetuating. The trouble is, the way in which it evolves could do great violence to the original purpose you intended. In this chapter, I'll describe several cultural viruses, institutions that have evolved away from their original purpose and become self-perpetuating. Television is a particularly efficient medium for meme evolution. New shows or commercials can reach hundreds of millions of people at once. If the shows catch on, if they have good memes, the producers are rewarded with inpourings of sponsors' money. The advertising agencies are rewarded with more business, and the sponsors themselves sell more of their product. All this happens relatively quickly, perhaps in a matter of weeks or months, as opposed to the old days when culture spread mostly by countries trading with and conquering one another over the course of decades or centuries. Scares about so-called subliminal advertising have abounded in recent years. The idea is that unscrupulous marketeers have put hidden images, voices, or symbols into their ads for the purpose of manipulating people into buying products that they otherwise wouldn't buy. The story goes that one liquor company had an artist airbrush the word sex into the random arrangement of ice cubes in a glass, or that a seemingly innocent arrangement of random objects secretly formed a likeness of a naked and seductive woman. This raises a lot of questions, whether you see those images when you peer intently at the suspect ads or not. But supposing subliminal images do exist, how did they get there? Are there really evil geniuses intentionally manipulating and enslaving our minds? Or is the presence of these images nothing more interesting than looking up at the clouds and seeing a ducky and a horsey? I don't know. But if we get stuck on that question, we are falling into the biggest trap of all in understanding cultural evolution. It's the trap that conspiracy theorists fall into, and the same trap that people who poo-poo conspiracy theories fall into. It's the mistaken belief that anything complicated must arise out of conscious intention. Complicated things arise naturally out of the forces of evolution. No conscious intention is necessary. Does subliminal advertising work? Sure, ads can have parts that you don't become consciously aware of, but which draw your attention unconsciously. If the ad pushes more of your buttons as a result of the subliminal content, you'll pay more attention to it. Paying more attention is the first step toward paying more money. It can work in reverse, too. Some fast food restaurants paint their walls orange because they believe it creates subliminal discomfort. You'll want to spend less time lingering there, and your leaving opens up tables for new customers. But don't think that subliminal ads are the only problem, as should be obvious to everyone who has watched the evolution of television programming for more than a few years. Efforts to attract your attention are not limited to the subliminal. The television is screaming at us day and night with all the greatest button-pushing memes there are. Danger, food, sex, authority. We don't even have to believe it's real for it to attract our attention. Remember, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV? Not only commercials, but also programs are evolving to command a greater share of your mind, and to say they are doing it subliminally would be an almost humorous understatement. Baywatch, a show with little plot but lots of bare skin, became the most watched television show in the history of the world. Female breasts, naked or otherwise, tend to command men's attention, and hence they tend to proliferate. A casual observer will notice that the inclusion of breasts, not to mention the rest of the female anatomy, in much male-oriented advertising is far from subliminal. Advertisers have learned to push your buttons. They also have learned a good deal about programming you with all kinds of memes. It's not the subliminal that we need to be concerned with. It's that they now have the knowledge to unleash full-blown designer mind viruses through their advertisements. And the effects of that are unpredictable and frightening. Imagine it's 1960. Television advertising is in its tender youth. Ad agencies in New York and Los Angeles abound, all trying different strategies and campaigns to advertise their clients' products successfully. They're all running their ideas up the flagpole, but only a few get the salutes required for success, promotion, and unabashed copying by everyone else in the business. Some campaigns work, some don't. The ones that don't are quickly killed, as few advertisers can afford to prolong an expensive promotion that isn't paying dividends and attracting the attention of customers, and therefore their money. The ones that succeed are copied with various creative changes made, intentionally or unintentionally, because the copier didn't understand what was effective about the original ad, yielding another generation of fitter ads. It's almost the reverse of the way some animals have genetically evolved camouflage to make themselves less visible. Like colorful flowers evolving to attract pollinators, these commercials have evolved in the world of memes to make themselves more visible and attract you. After several years and without any evil top executives scheming about the best way to manipulate the American public, most ad agencies are putting out commercials featuring the big button-pushing memes, danger, food, and sex. Soon they start fine-tuning them, still through the automatic and unconspiratorial process of meme evolution, to include some of the other button pushers, helping children, listening to authority, the unusual, a sense of belonging, and so on. Ads could have evolved to where they are today simply through the natural process of competition, even if there were never an awareness on the part of ad agency executives about the button-pushing effect these memes had on people. Of course, there was an awareness of the button-pushing effect. In fact, advertising runs hand-in-hand with politics in its calculating manipulation of the masses. Did the makers of Joe Camel deliberately set out to hook kids on Camel cigarettes by presenting a lovable cartoon figure smoking their instrument of death? Who knows? It does have that effect, according to at least one study, but that doesn't prove conscious intent. It's a very attractive trap to start looking for who to blame for what people consider the decline of our culture. When culture evolves in the direction of more powerful memes, it does little good to single people out to blame. As you know by now, that's the natural order of things. If we want to combat the mind viruses responsible for the decline of culture, we need to be conscious of our own programming, consciously adopting memes that take us in the direction we want to go. Another effect of meme evolution on advertising is the divergence of advertising content from product content. As a kid, I remember noticing the Coca-Cola company changing its slogan from "Drink Coca-Cola" to "Enjoy Coca-Cola" to "Things Go Better with Coke." Somewhere along the line, somebody realized that they didn't really have to discuss the product itself, just create a mood full of enough attractive elements that people took notice and felt good when they saw the product. They created an association meme in the customer. The athletic shoes we used to call sneakers no longer get promoted by mothers swearing to the long life of the brand. Now special effects surround famous athletes, poetic quotes, and rap music. Speaking of music, do you have a favorite song that's been ruined forever by an ad that used your enjoyment of it as a Trojan horse? Advertisers are selling a feeling. They're using Trojan horse techniques that hook into your feel-good buttons so they can unload their bundle of memes into your mind once they have your attention. In some cases, this transformation of commercials into direct communicators of powerful feelings has brought them full circle into the realm of art. Many of today's commercials feature miniature dramas, comedies, music videos, or even experimental surrealism completely unrelated to the products they're selling, except for the mention of their name or a brief picture. It's a world within a world. Beer commercials are notorious for this kind of treatment. "Sell the sizzle, not the steak," goes the advertising truism. Well, why not, when you're pushing a product made from rotten vegetation whose primary effects are to dull your wits, pad your paunch, and make you belch, any sizzle would be a big help. Ever since Anheuser-Busch decided to bill its anything-but-outstanding Budweiser as the king of beers, the trend has been away from claims, true or not, about the product's competitive advantages, and more toward building an image or mood. The ads that push people's buttons are the successful ones. You don't have to have a PhD in media studies to notice that sex plays a big role in beer commercials. What does all this mean to you and me? It means that if we watch commercial television, we're guaranteed to be influenced in both our thinking and our behavior by the powerful memes being broadcast at us. Anyone who claims television is not a great shaper of our culture is either naive or mistaken. If television didn't have at least as great an effect on our behavior as one might suspect, Advertisers would not pay billions of dollars a year to shape our buying habits. And shaped we are, both by the commercials and the program content. While it might not be apparent to the casual viewer, most of the people who appear as experts or celebrities on talk shows are there in order to promote themselves or their agenda, to spread memes. To illustrate how important this is, a hardcover book generally needs to sell 5,000 copies in a week to make the New York Times bestseller list. A single appearance by an author on Oprah commonly sells 100,000 copies of a book. But you have to write a book that Oprah wants on her show. There's no doubt that the visual media have influenced the publishing industry. Large advances go not to books with literary value, but to those that are promotable. They have components that will push people's buttons. Cynics perennially ask why life and culture, and television in particular, seem to be filling up with valueless and demeaning junk rather than artistic and thoughtful content. The answer is, of course, that the valueless and demeaning junk is a better replicator. If you're interested in filling the airwaves with art and literature, you've got to make them better replicators. There are two ways to make something a better replicator: make it better exploit the environment, or change the environment to its advantage. Using the first method, you could create art and literature that presses people's buttons, such as Robert Mapplethorpe's erotic photographs or MTV's music videos. Alternatively, you could work to change the selection process for what goes on the air, not likely anytime soon in the U.S., given how fundamental the free market is. The difference in program content of the non-commercial PBS versus commercial networks shows what a difference the selective environment makes in determining what cultural replicators win the battle for survival. One controversial method of making art a better replicator is the colorization of old black and white movies. While the additional visual appeal of color generates more viewers, colorization offends traditionalists, who especially resent tampering with films without the director's permission. The most offensive example I've ever seen of tampering with artistic content for the sake of increasing viewership is the practice of showing a preview of a gripping scene in the next segment of the movie at the start of each commercial break. That's right, they show you a scene you haven't seen yet, out of order, in an attempt to create sufficient interest for you to stick around through the commercials. The point is, the institution of television, while originally created as entertainment, has evolved into a self-perpetuating cultural virus with little possibility of anything but broadcasting the most gripping, button-pushing sounds and images. That's true not only of the entertainment portion of television, but also of the news. The idea behind freedom of speech, in the minds of the framers of the Constitution, was that if all ideas were given equal opportunity to compete in a sort of free market of the mind, the truth would emerge victorious. Unfortunately, this is not the case. It's successful mind viruses that emerge victorious, spreading their selfish memes. Truth is not one of the strong selectors for memes. Making sense is a selector, since people have a drive to make sense of things, but as we know, that doesn't always correspond to truth. What laws govern our existence? Everybody understands the basics of astrology, which is not to say they believe it, but selecting one of 12 signs based on your birthday is easy to understand. That meme spreads much better than a more scientific theory such as quantum physics, in which the fundamental particles don't map easily onto people's birthdays. All this makes life difficult for those heralds and guardians of the truth, the news media. Constantly accused of bias and unfair reporting, members of this noble profession have a tough time balancing truth and objectivity against saying something interesting enough, pushing enough buttons, that people will listen to what they're saying. Advocacy journalists, such as talk show host Rush Limbaugh, devote their airtime to promoting a particular point of view. Newspaper columnists such as PJ O'Rourke do the same in the print medium. These people collect evidence to support their point of view, then put it out in an entertaining and button-pushing fashion, in an effort both to gain converts and to increase their audience. Of course, the more buttons they push, the more people pay attention to them. Newspapers typically put columnists in a special section called Opinion and Editorial, or op-ed. advertising clearly the distinction between these biased pieces and the so-called unbiased rest of the paper. It's in the rest of the paper that the trouble starts. Because even if we grant that most journalists are good people of high integrity, the very assumption that it's possible to be unbiased is flawed. Having a nation of reporters running around believing they're unbiased and a nation of news consumers making the same assumption leads to a lot of problems. The whole news reporting mechanism, with billions of copies of information being made every day, is a prime breeding ground for mind viruses. The culture of journalism is rife with mind viruses that have spread certain biases, certain memes, deeply throughout it, without any conscious intent on the part of individual journalists to be biased. The news media must decide what's important enough to be called news, and that judgment is inherently biased in several ways. In the first place, any successful reporter is biased against the status quo, because nobody would go out and buy a newspaper that said day after day, things are fine, nothing to worry about. The things are fine meme is a very weak one, not pressing any of our major buttons. We'd ignore it. The paper would go out of business. The reporter would starve to death. That would be news. Rumblings of a liberal bias in the news media during the Reagan and Bush presidencies quickly turned to grumblings about conservative hate-mongering when the more liberal Clinton was elected. Which one is true? Neither. In reality, the bias in the media isn't liberal or conservative. It's towards stories that push our buttons, meaning that we buy their papers, listen to their shows, and keep them in business. People's drive toward making sense of senseless things leads to a type of cultural virus known as conspiracy theory. Over the years, people have suspected conspiracies in everything, from the assassination of John F. Kennedy to the supposed plot by the American Medical Association to keep us dependent on medical care by limiting the potency of over-the-counter vitamins. Do such conspiracies really exist on a large scale? Or are they just isolated incidents such as Watergate, doomed to be uncovered because of the sheer difficulty of keeping a secret among so many people? A belief system, through its memes, can spread in a way that looks just like a conspiracy without any conscious intention on the part of the participants. Is there a conspiracy among America's farmers and the government to push meat and dairy products on us, knowing that the high fat content of these foods will damage our health? The farmers just want to sell their products to stay in business. Their lobbyists support politicians who see things their way, and pretty soon we've got television ads and government programs all proclaiming the benefits of eggs and pork, the other white meat. How about the American Medical Association? Do they have a secret session at their annual meeting where they discuss ways to cripple the American public to increase their business? They've just been programmed with the meme that they, as educated health specialists, are best qualified to regulate and dispense health care. From this core belief come policy decisions such as their stand on over-the-counter vitamins and regulation of nutritional supplements. But don't conclude that conspiracies are impossible to keep secret. In fact, all but the most interesting conspiracies are extremely easy to keep secret, simply because news about them won't spread if it doesn't have good memes. A few years ago, the top three manufacturers of plastic dinnerware were found to have conspired to a price-fixing scheme. It was covered in a small article in the Seattle Times. What? You hadn't heard about it? That conspiracy was kept secret simply because most people had no interest in hearing about it. The story had bad memes. It's incredibly hard to be heard. Businesses spend billions of dollars a year on public relations agencies and advertising, trying to get their message out. Why would we think that a single leak by a conspirator would blow the whole thing wide open? It took many people working hard for many months to uncover the juiciest parts of the Watergate scandal, and that was an affair in the national spotlight. Even that wouldn't have come out if Nixon hadn't taped himself doing illegal things. Why did he do it? Like the meat and dairy farmers taken to another degree, he was so immersed in his belief system, making the practicalities of re-election so important, that he simply didn't see himself as doing anything wrong. To him, it wasn't a conspiracy, it was just a strategy meeting. Like members of religions that practice ritual sacrifice of human beings, the Watergate conspirators had a set of beliefs that drove them to do things that mainstream America considered reprehensible. it's difficult to step out of your own mimetic programming and see yourself as others see you. You don't automatically pay attention to everything you see and hear. You automatically filter out things that don't coincide with your worldview, and that includes conspiracies, unless, of course, you're a conspiracy buff, in which case you tend to see them everywhere. It depends on your worldview, your context. When something unusual or ironic occurs, though, people want to know about it. Another bias in the media, a bias toward the unusual and offbeat. However, the amplifying power of the media gives people a distorted impression of the world because the media rarely report the mundane and ordinary. We watch television, see crime, disasters, and superhuman athletic feats, and form a picture of the world having little to do with our day-to-day experience. The problem is, going through life with a distorted picture of the world handicaps us. In 1992, 37,776 people were killed by guns in the United States. Another 40,982 were killed by cars. Yet a casual look at reporting would verify that guns get much more coverage than automobiles, even though almost half the gun deaths, over 18,000, were suicides. I'm not saying guns shouldn't get more coverage. After all, this gun problem is growing, while the car problem has been with us for decades. But people get a distorted picture of the dangers involved. Just doing a simple calculation, the chance of any one person dying in an automobile accident in a given year in the U.S. are 1 in 6,224. The chance of dying in a gun incident other than suicide is less than half as likely, 1 in 13,005. If you put yourself in a low-risk group by not being a criminal or police officer, the odds get considerably better. But what are people more afraid of, guns or cars? If you're like most people, the answer is guns, and it's likely because of the distorted media coverage. This kind of distorted coverage leads to an outcry from the populace, which often leads to politicians going off, forgive the pun, half-cocked, with solutions to the problem. Now let's get a handle on what it really means to have a 1 in 6,500 or a 1 in 13,000 chance of dying. It's as if you lived on an island in the South Pacific with a population of 650. You make your living by swimming around in the azure waters around your idyllic paradise and spearing fish for dinner. About once every 10 years, a stray shark happens by and eats a swimmer. That's a 1 in 6,500 chance of any one person being eaten by a shark, just the same as the odds of dying in an automobile accident in the U.S. in 1992. Also, about once every 20 years, two men get into an overheated argument over a fish or a woman, and one of them kills the other with his spear. That's a 1 in 13,000 chance of being killed in an argument, just the same as the odds of being killed by someone else with a gun in the U.S. in 1992. These are very sad events, and probably dinner table conversation for quite a few days, but not the be-all and end-all of life. Fortunately, since you live on an isolated island, these events come and go, and life goes on. But now imagine there are 392,000 of these islands, all linked by television and the INN Island News Network. This brings the total population up to about 254 million, less than in the U.S. today. Every night, INN reports on the goriest of the 107 shark attacks and 54 spear deaths that day. Suddenly, people's picture of the world is quite different. From a peaceful existence disrupted only by a tragedy every few years, you go to a fear-ridden hell filled with crime and terror. Isn't this interesting? Nothing has changed, except the addition of television. Yet now it feels like you're living in a dangerous world, not an idyllic paradise. Same number of shark attacks, same number of spear deaths. What happened? Television news. It's provided a new and powerful means of spreading memes that push our danger button. But sitting in front of the television getting scared about danger halfway across the world isn't very useful and doesn't add much to our quality of life. It's like an addiction, a drug. We have very real buttons that get pressed when we see danger, buttons that drive us to pay attention to it. It takes substantial mental effort to pry ourselves away from it. Back in our former paradise, people start demanding that the government do something about this new perceived danger. Politicians start talking about a 5-day waiting period for spear purchases. Entrepreneurs start running half-hour infomercials for shark repellent. But underneath it all, the tragedy is that people don't enjoy life as much anymore. They live in fear. Fear brought about by nothing more than television news. Did it have to happen this way? What if the people who invented television news had decided to cover good, heartwarming news rather than scary, dangerous news? For one thing, to stay in business, the news media have to report things that people are interested in. Those things are nothing more or less than memes that push our buttons. Now, silly us for having stupid buttons like danger, crisis, power, territory, and so on. But the fact is, without appealing to these buttons, the masses will not tune in and the network will go out of business. You probably know people who are addicted to TV news as well as other kinds of media stimulation. It's like a drug of the mind, capturing your attention and giving little in return. Technology is by no means the only driving force behind cultural viruses. People in big cities don't give many handouts to beggars anymore. The business of begging is just as subject to mimetic evolution as all other institutions. It seems the ineffective beggars, probably those you'd want to help, have been driven out by the ones who've learned to be good at it. Being good at begging means having the right memes to attract donations. A be aggressive strategy meme has been successful. Other strategy memes I've noticed working for beggars are beg with children or animals, stand at a busy intersection with a traffic light, and have a sign saying, "We'll work for food." I actually heard a beggar on talk radio comparing techniques, and he highly recommended the last two of those three. He noted that he'd never actually worked for food. People just handed him money through their car windows, especially middle-aged women. Begging has evolved into a cultural virus that perpetuates itself through ever more effective methods, now being spread even over mass media. The most effective participants in this virus make a fair living at it, according to their own statements, and drive out the people who actually need help. This force of meme evolution, away from original intent and toward exploitation of the system, works just as surely with government handouts, be they welfare programs or tax breaks. Power corrupts, no doubt about it. Federal bureaucracies grow fat and wasteful. Politicians cater to special interest groups or worse. Big businesses shower ineffective executives with lavish salaries and fringe benefits. We know about all of this, and many of us have grown jaded and grudgingly accepting of this black eye on the face of society. We catch them when we can and toss them out of office or even into jail for a few months, but it's just a fact of life, isn't it? Power corrupts. What I once thought was a cynical, pessimistic worldview, I now understand to be the natural result of meme evolution. Mind viruses exploit instruction-obeying mechanisms. If power is defined as the ability to have others follow your instructions, it's not a difficult leap to see why evolutionary forces tend to attack and corrupt any concentration of power. The very instant we set up a bureaucracy, a government, a big business with extraordinary power over our lives, corruption begins. Little by little, the good intentions originally present in the organization become stifled, choked, or even replaced by an evolving set of memes that have no claim to power other than that they are good at spreading. The forces of meme evolution are unbelievably powerful. Take a look at that unshakable bedrock of government, the U.S. Constitution. Ratified in 1788 and designed by some savvy people with first-hand knowledge of the corruption possible in a big centralized government, it contained many provisions devised to safeguard against that happening in their new country. But little by little, and always for what seemed to be good reasons, power shifted from the people and states to the federal government. Did you know the original Constitution prohibited the direct taxation of people by the federal government? The IRS was unconstitutional. The framers knew that with centralized taxation comes central